Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will look at eating disorders. Experts say these conditions are on the rise in Africa and represent a mental health crisis. But first, tuberculosis is preventable and curable, yet it is the world's leading infectious disease killer. In 2023, 8.2 million people were newly diagnosed with TB, according to the World Health Organization. That's the highest number the world has seen since 1995. Over the past 6 years, the BEAT tuberculosis study conducted in South Africa on children and pregnant women has revealed a promising new oral treatment that could mark a significant breakthrough in the fight against drug-resistant TB, the Dahi Kasim reports.
These pills are part of a drug trial in South Africa that may help revolutionize tuberculosis therapy. A new regimen cured 85 to 90% patients with drug-resistant TB, up from 50% for previous regimens.
We found safe and effective treatment for pregnant women and children, but also we've awakened the field to say, actually, this has to be done.
Women, children, and men in the BEAT tuberculosis trial all received the same regimen. That's a change from previous treatments, even though TB often affects entire families.
The daddy gets one easy regimen to take, and then the mom gets a more complicated one because she's pregnant, and the child gets an even more complicated one. Dad is cured after 6 months. Mom is cured after 8 months. And we wait, or 9 months. We wait for 18 months for us to be able to know if the child is cured. So that's really an unfortunate set of circumstances.
Dr. Pauline Howell supervised the study. She says the new regimen has the backing of the World Health Organization.
That basically means that countries can take the recommendation of the regimen and run with it, which is fantastic, because the more options we give countries to work with, the more options we can then translate to patients who need treatment.
Leslie Marbury is Southern African Mission Director for the United States Agency for International Development. She says breakthroughs like this new treatment could eventually pave the way for a world free of, or at least less troubled by, TB.
They're coming from high burden countries like South Africa who are motivated, then I feel confident that we can end tuberculosis as a global health challenge.
TB claims over 1 million lives each year, but experts say with early detection, simplified treatment regimens. Sahil Kassim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Health experts from around the world are gathered in Bali, Indonesia, this week for the Union World Conference on Lung Health to look at what's needed to sustain the global fight to end tuberculosis, especially in high-burden countries. To find out more, I spoke with Dr. Nilesh Bhatt, infectious disease specialist and research director at the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, EGPAF.
This week we are having this TB Union Conference in Indonesia from 2012 to 16. And one of the big priority is to discuss a bit more on access. As we know, is one of the important focus. TB research and development is currently experiencing a boom. And there is an incredible advancement in the innovative tools and to end basically the TB epidemic, right? So as we know, so these innovations like short treatment regimens, new diagnostic tests, even the effective vaccines, they are very limited and not affordable. You know, they may not be available in certain geographic areas. And so those are the things that we're going to discuss during the meeting. But in addition to that, there might be also some additional discussions on the new diagnostics and treatments, because that's really important to end the TB epidemic.
Why is TB making a resurgence as the world's leading infectious disease killer? What's behind the worrying global statistic in the WHO's global TB report released recently?
Yeah, that's a good question. As we know, the TB has long been among us since very long, right? It's one of the top infectious disease killers, but has been surpassed by COVID in 2020 and 2021. So based on the recent WHO report, like 8.2 million people were newly diagnosed with TB. And this is the highest number of new infection in any given year since WHO started like producing this report. And well, I mean, it's important to kind of understand the reasons behind this high incidence. And with many TB services and resources being diverted to address COVID-19, and with many people being afraid to go to the health facilities, you know, during the COVID pandemic, the TB response was hit. But the new data in this year from WHO shows signs that TB has started to stabilize in following years of this disruption.
The TB report has good news for Africa. The region appears to have made significant progress toward ending TB as a public health threat. According to the report, six countries in Africa are close to achieving the 2025 NTB strategy milestone of 75% reduction. Which African countries are making the most progress and how did they do it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So basically some African countries like Mozambique, Zambia, Uganda, they have achieved high levels of treatment coverage. So let me give you an example of one of the country. In Mozambique, for instance, the National TB Control Program has successfully improved the TB control through early detection with tools like molecular, which are based in molecular technology, like GeneXpert, and even like the chest x-rays. But from other side, there are like integration of TB care services with other services like maternal child and health and HIV services. Also involvement, engagement, early engagement of the community health workers. I mean, it's really important to kind of trace TB in the community. But also, like, since there are clinical trials that are coming up, like, you know, translating evidence that are being generated into the policies are also important. So I feel these countries are successfully working along those paths in order that they can reduce the burden of TB in the countries as well. Yeah.
The progress we're seeing in these African countries appear very similar to what we have seen with the UNAIDS global report. African countries making tremendous progress in tackling HIV compared to the rest of the world. Is there a link between the progress that Africa has made in the fight against HIV and the strides in the fight to end TB?
Yeah, so basically, you know, if we see the funding that are coming for HIV, definitely it's much higher than the funding that are being made available for TB. And we know that despite being the number one infectious disease killer globally, you know, the TB has historically suffered from a lack of political will and financial investment. So we really need to work together, you know, policymakers, researchers, a community, stakeholders, you know, to kind of reassure that the funding for the program, but also for the research are being made available. So I think that's one of the big issue. And just for your information, like last year, there was a UN high level meeting on TB. And at that meeting, countries from around the world came together to pledge to by 2027, invest $22 billion annually for TB diagnostic, treatment and prevention services. But if you see the numbers from the last report, only 5.7 billion were made available. So we are like approximately 20% of needed budget to kind of tackle, you know, the TB. So we really need to pledge countries and big donors, right, you know, to kind of continue to provide their support and the commitment to end, to fight against the TB and end TB.
The Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, EGPAF, is sounding the alarm around pediatric TB, saying that children under the age of 5 are least likely to be diagnosed with TB, even though some of them are affected. Why is this that, and what can be done about this?
Yeah, that's really important. And it's silent, basically. And really, Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation has been in their priority, you know, work, and it's part of the people and agenda, you know, the pediatric TB. Unfortunately, you know, the case finding is the biggest gap in the pediatric services. So we are not able to find the pediatric TB cases. It's not because they are not there. They are. The issue is the most of existing tools to diagnose TB, pediatric TB, are less effective in children than in adults. And they require invasive sample collection procedures, which definitely the children, they will not like to do, right? So we really need to kind of find the missing children by scaling up screening and diagnostic key tests to pediatric TB. But also I think the country should prioritize contact investigator to identify and screen for all children and adolescents in those who are in close contact with a person with active TB. Another thing which I feel it's important, we really need to continue to invest in the research development and rollout of more effective child-friendly diagnostic tools and treatments, which are right now not very much available across the globe.
Another concern is drug-resistant TB. The WHO reports say it remains a public health crisis. What is the latest in medical advancement and treatment when it comes to drug-resistant TB?
I mean, giving you some context about the drug-resistant TB, I mean, this remains a significant global health challenge, as it doesn't respond to standard antibiotics that are used to treat the drug-sensitive TB, so it making it harder to treat and cure. And due to that, you know, the drug-resistant TB, leads to a longer illness, the higher death rates and increased health outcomes, right? The health costs as well. And we will find those health costs particularly higher in the low-income countries where access to medicines and funding is also limited. So drug-resistant TB can develop in the because of treatment, which is incorrect or incomplete, and or antibiotics are misused. There are many potential important advances in management drug resistance, but just to highlight, there are right now WHO has approved new medication that can be used against the resistant strains, and the new treatment regimens are shorter, all oral, which also improve the adherence to the treatment, and there are new diagnostic tools that can be used to identify drug resistant cases. So right now there are like a lot of advances, but a lot to be done yet, since the drug resistance TB estimation, you know, are higher than what really we are able to diagnose right now. Yeah.
So what will it take to move the needle in the fight against drug resistance TB?
Yeah, no, sure, definitely. I mean, the big issue is we really need to continue to work hand on hand with the scientific community program implementers, I mean, the funders as well, just to make sure that we are identifying cases and also we are treating those cases, but also addressing the need to prevent more cases in the community. So, you know, I mean, it's a huge issue that we really need to tackle. But, you know, the funding is one of the main issue, and really we need to work through that process.
And speaking of funding, it's a harsh reality that health experts are faced with. In your view, where would you like to see that financial investment come from? And what would you say are the financial and political commitments and action needed for the global community to end TB as a global public health threat?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, you know, as we know, like the traditionally, a substantial proportion of funding has come from domestic resources. It means that, you know, the country's fundings, they are funding their own TB responses, TB activities and work plans. And we know that the amount of domestic resources available has reduced tremendously, especially after the COVID-19 for several reasons. And we feel that countries won't be able to kind of continue to afford those costs because there are other priorities as well, right? HIV is another priority, cervical cancer, cancer and other things. So we really need to kind of come along and continue to discuss, you know, how to can get more domestic but also international resources, such as from the United States, the Global Fund, and other countries are both needed to close the funding gap. Yeah.
And any final words before we wrap?
Yeah, no, I think definitely. I think we need to kind of continue to focus, also in the pediatric TB, but also in TB in the pregnant woman. I mean, those are the two, I would say subgroup of population that are left behind. And I think we really need to kind of invest energy to kind of bring them in the core of the disease so we can tackle the TB also in those populations.
Dr. Nilesh Bhatt, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting me, Lina.
That was Dr. Nilesh Bhatt, infectious disease specialist and research director at the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, speaking to us from Bali, Indonesia. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. We turn now to eating disorders. Classified as a mental health issue, an eating disorder is an abnormal eating behavior that negatively affects a person's physical or emotional health. According to the World Health Organization, anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating are among the most common eating disorders worldwide. And about 70 million people suffer from these illnesses, especially in wealthy countries. However, these disorders are also becoming rampant in Africa, where healthcare systems in low and middle income countries are often unprepared to identify or address them. These health disorders require more attention. Collins Adede has more from Mombasa, Kenya.
Nutritionists say eating disorders are mental health conditions to help the body mechanism cope with issues such as anxiety or depression. These conditions include anorexia, which is the fear of eating, bulimia, the desire to eat excessively in a short period of time, or binge eating. Nahashan Rop is a nutritionist based in Mombasa, Kenya.
It comes in different forms and also in different ages. And maybe just to highlight on that, so it can come in form of binge eating. So this is where by an individual eats a large quantity of food as form of coping mechanism to their anxiety or their depression. The second form, it could be avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. This is most common in the adolescent population.
Observers say eating disorders are becoming increasingly common in Africa. However, a lack of significant research makes it challenging to understand the full scope of the problem. Nahashan says social media and poverty are partly to blame for the rising number of cases on the continent.
There is this perception of a perfect person or a perfect body in the social media, because we are living in a digital age. Yeah, so social media is the biggest influence. The second thing is the economic hardships.
Here at the Real Health Parlor Eatery in Mombasa, Kenya, customers get to enjoy traditional foods made with natural ingredients. Martin Kariuki, a Jewish therapist, says in his 10-year practice, he has learned that indigenous foods are a perfect solution to correct some eating disorders.
For example, this smoothie has groundnuts, cashew nuts, pumpkin seeds, plus all the herbs you are seeing here. You can also chew this pumpkin seed, which has a huge nutritious value, such as zinc, magnesium, calcium, and this are what we need in our bodies.
Kariuki says natural food with low sugar and less fat can make a big difference in people's nutrition and wellness. Collins Adede, VOA Africa, Mombasa, Kenya.
We asked the listeners their thoughts on eating disorders and what can be done to help people who struggle with such disorders. Here are some reactions from Cameroon.
Eating disorders is an illness, mental illness, in which someone's attitude towards food and his weight is being disturbed. For example, we can see in anorexia nervosa, in which a person researches stubbornly thinness. He wants to maintain a thin shape because he restrains his or herself from eating certain things.
What comes in my mind when I hear eating disorder is the way of people eat. They eat exaggerated, so what caused them to become fat as I cannot explain it, because the way they eat, they don't control the way they eat, so it's what makes them to be fat. Sometimes they give them sickness.
With my different researches and with the observation I do in our daily environment and everywhere, I see people who are addicted to food. There are people who eat all around, morning, afternoon, evening, wherever they have found themselves, wherever they found food, they just allow themselves given to that. And there are other people who don't even eat at all. They can spend half days or even days without eating, and they have no problem concerning that.
For me, I can help people by advising them to eat correctly, at what time to eat, because eating at all time, it can cause people to be fat too much. But some people, it comes from their family and in genetics. For me, what can be done to help those people is, firstly, to secure them in a place where they will not be allowed to take all the things that they consume, to give them all that faith.
For me, what can be done to help those people is, first of all, sensibilize people concerning the knowledge of the sickness, because we can be people who are sick and not even aware of the fact that we are sick. So if we are not sensibilized on the reality of the sickness, people cannot be aware of the dangerosity of the sickness. And I think that another thing that can be done is the organization of seminars, workshops, where people can be invited, sensibilized on their turn on the reality of the sickness. And then I think that will help people taking knowledge of the mental disease and then allowing themselves to go even through some therapies in order to get out of the sickness.
Florence Eto'o is a dietitian in Ghana. She tells us more about eating disorders, how they affect patients in Africa, and what can be done.
Eating disorders, they are medical condition, mostly mental illnesses that are very severe. And it could be due to both genetic and environmental factors, or both. And they are usually characterized by unhealthy or abnormal eating behavior. There are a number of types, but the very common ones are the anorexia, which involves restricted eating, followed by a compensatory behavior. And then we have the bulimia, which is just binge eating a lot of food at a time, also followed by compensatory behavior. Then we have the restrictive eating disorder or binge eating disorder, where the individual just eats so much. They do not have control over their appetite. So it's just eating. Eating disorders is one of the psychological disorders. So if the individual is not even accepting that it is a disorder and it's a problem that has to be addressed, then there's a difficulty or a challenge in addressing it. So one of the main challenges will be accepting that it is an illness and then accepting to follow the procedure that will be used in treating it. The good thing is that eating disorders can be completely and successfully treated. But if you haven't accepted that it's a disorder, then it may not be treated. Culturally, we have situations that force individuals to unconsciously practice abnormal eating behaviors. And then the societal pressure, especially for growing people, younger people, there's the expected weight, there's approved weight that young people usually will fall under those pressures, and that would encourage unhealthy or abnormal eating behaviors. So because it is both a medical and psychological illness, it is treated both ways. So it involves team approach in managing the condition. So you need a medical practitioner, you need a psychologist, and then you need a dietitian to help with the dietary management.
We turn now to cancer. In labs across the United States, scientists are working on innovative tests using animals and insects to detect cancer early. As VOA's Dora McCuar reports, recent research suggests bees and dogs can sniff out the disease sooner than machines can.
Earlier this year, researchers at Michigan State University discovered that honeybees could detect lung cancer due to their keen sense of smell. Debajit Saha is an assistant professor of biomedical engineering at Michigan State University.
Our world is visual. Insects' world is all based on smell. So their sense of smell is very, very good.
Saha's team found the bees could sniff out lung cancer on a patient's breath.
So our research does show that honeybees can detect lung cancer and possibly other diseases based on the smell of those cells.
The bees were harnessed and then exposed to synthetic compounds that mimic the breath of a lung cancer patient. 93% of the time, the bees could tell the difference between the cancer breath and the artificial breath of a healthy person. The bees could also distinguish between the different types of lung cancer.
We do think breath-based diagnostics of cancer can be a game changer. The reason is many times we detect the cancer late, when the tumor has already grown pretty big that you can identify in your imaging system.
Elsewhere, researchers are working with dogs for early cancer detection. The animals are trained to recognize specific cancer odors. Dr. Cindy Otto is executive director of the Penn Vet Working Dog Center at the University of Pennsylvania.
A lot of other animals also have quite intense and capable senses of smell, but part of what makes dogs so good is that they cooperate with humans, and so they communicate that information.
Clara Wilson is a researcher at the Penn Vet Working Dog Center.
They need to love it to be engaged, and so it's a really fun game for them. It's like using their brain, using their nose. It's pretty hard.
Dogs might see it as a game, but researchers are finding they detect cancer better than machines do. Amritha Mullikarjun is a researcher at the Penn Vet Working Dog Center.
So why are we finding that these dogs are outperforming the computers? Well, part of their success is because of this superior sensitivity to detect odor molecules as compared to anything we currently have on the market.
As dogs help with the work of isolating the characteristics of cancer odors, the hope is e-noses can eventually be created that will replicate these canines' cancer-sniffing abilities. Dora McCuar, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linoch Mudu in Washington, with producer Mugbil Yabaro and engineer Adrius Regis. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.